Let's talk. John Brown. Gaudi, God's architect. Antonio Gaudi's architecture is amongst the world's most instantly recognizable sites. His still unfinished Basilica, La Sagrada Familia, welcomes 5 million visitors annually. Yet in this 100th anniversary of his death, knocked down in the street by a tram, much remains unknown, unanswered about this otherworldly genius. That is to say that one man who's trying to put his finger on the elusive Catalan genius is my next guest, and it's Peter Stanford. Peter, good morrow to you, sir.
Good morning, good morning. Very nice to be with you.
Good to have you back on Talk Radio Europe, because last time you were on, I believe you were talking to Hannah about Angels, which was your previous book, wasn't it? Well, one of your previous
books. It was indeed. I float around, no pun intended, between different subjects.
Well, I mean, you can say Angels, but, you know, Gaudi perhaps has a connection with the divine, with his architecture that is instantly recognisable, and yet there is so much, perhaps, that people don't know about the man himself. So where do you come to when you come to write a book about an architect whose architecture is instantly recognisable? Because people will see the Sagrada and go, oh, that's Gaudi, and in a way that they wouldn't be able to do about any other architect, perhaps, in, you know, from antiquity to the modern day, and brutalists notwithstanding.
Indeed. And one of the extraordinary things about him is that his architecture is so instantly recognisable. Mm. And it's instantly recognisable because it's so different from anybody else's. So one of the questions that you have to try and answer about him is, where does that come from? Why is what he does so was very, very different at the time and has been very different since? So the way that architecture works, I've learned, I'm not an architect, one of the reasons I wrote the book was because most of the books written about him,
yeah,
he never wrote anything himself, literally never wrote anything down himself, but most of the books written about him are written by architectural historians. So what they're trying to do all the time is say, it's all about the kind of canon of architecture and who stands on whose shoulders. So he did it this way because he was copying this person, and when he died, somebody else copied him and made it this way. So you have this whole emerging kind of continuous thread. He completely breaks the thread. Anyone who's seen any of his buildings, particularly the Sagrada Familia, it's all curves and swirls, and these, on the Sagrada Familia, those extraordinary towers, those 18 towers that look like nothing else. I mean, people say they look like honeycombs, people say they look like beehives, drippy candles, all sorts of different things. But what's absolutely true is they're like nothing else.
But here's the thing, perhaps. You one might argue, Peter, and please, it's Friday, it's a beautiful sunny day here in the baking heat of Andalusia, but you might say, well, you know, it's cathedrals, it's a huge tower, so he's getting a bit sort of mock Gothic on this. And you can also say, hang on a second, you know, it's a centenary to death, which means it's 1920s, which means we're coming out of the artwork, coming out of Dada, we're going into surrealism. Perhaps his artwork is inspired by that. Or you can say, architecturally, you know, if you go to look at some of the curves and swirls that are in Art Nouveau in places like Brussels and Belgium, another, you know, Northern European, and it's putting a Catalan swirl on that tradition. I mean,
good architectural knowledge there. You're a secret architect, and you're
Lego and Meccano at home, Peter.
Oh, really? Okay. You are absolutely right. There are certainly elements of lots of those things. So the dominant movement, particularly in Barcelona at the time he was operating, was called Modernismo, which was what the Catalans called, what we would have called Art Nouveau in England, different names across the continent. So lots of kind of curves in all of that. There was something radically different in lots of ways, and lots of people, there was innovation in there for a start. So one of his most famous buildings, again, anyone who's been to Barcelona will have walked down the Passeig de Gràcia, the kind of Park Lane of Barcelona. There's two fantastic ones, all almost opposite each other. One is the Casa Bayo, which looks like it looks like you're underwater. It looks like an impressionist painting. It looks like Disney. People have all sorts of different words for it. One of the things about him is people can never quite agree what the right words are for it. And then on the other corner, you've got this fabulous Casa Mia, which is like a kind of rock face, and it's all movement and all facing. movement, of course, big thing in modernism. So there are lots of things that he shares with people. But when people asked him where he got his ideas from, like these fantastic towers on the Sagrada Familia, and the whole, the one that's just been finished, so they put the foundation stone in 144 years ago, and they are just about to finish the building. They've still got a few problems left with it, but the towers are all up there. So the tallest one is 556 feet. It is the tallest, it makes it the tallest church in the world. So the idea was to dominate the horizon. So everyone looking over Barcelona would think, well, it's a Christian city, there's a church. But of course, it doesn't particularly look much like churches are meant to look. It looks like, who knows what it looks like. So when Gaudi was asked in his lifetime, so where do these ideas come from? He would raise his eyes heavenwards and say, you know, God is my client. My architecture comes from two things, he'd say. One was God, and the other was the book of nature. Two books, he said, you had to read to understand his architecture. One was the Bible, and the other was the book of nature. And of course, he believed that nature was created by God. So he was a profoundly religious man. So if you think of lots of the really great architects, Michelangelo, Bernini, all these people who built St. Peter's and Florence, all those things, they weren't particularly religious themselves. They had a religious sensibility. But with Gaudi, it was sort of a vocation. So then you have to start asking, when he said he got his ideas from God, what exactly did he mean? Did he mean that God was sitting there in heaven, drawing up some plans for him, giving them to an angel? The angel would come down the ladder, hand them over, and it wasn't. Of course he didn't mean that. What he meant was they came from this extraordinary religious tradition and background and experience he'd had growing up of rituals, rites, images, all those things. He was drawing on all of those things. That was one thing. The other thing that he was drawing on, and he grew up near a city called Reus in Catalonia, which is right next to it is the Baixa Camp, that yep. flat area between the mountains. So many of his buildings are between the mountains and the sea. And the two that I've just mentioned to you, Casabayo and Casamilla, one is the mountains. It looks like a mountain. And on the other side of the Passage de Gracia is the Casabayo, which looks like it's underwater. So in a sense, there's the mountains and the sea, between mountains and sea. And he explored this area so much, and lots of the shapes that you see in his buildings and come from that drawing from nature. So two really quick examples. When you walk along the Passage de Gracia, outside both those buildings, he did the pavements outside them as well. And the pavements are all ceramic tiles that have got little bits of crustaceans of fish skeletons and fish bones in them. They all came from the Baixa camp. It's either flooded with water or it's bone dry. And so he would crawl around as a child and find all these shapes. Interesting those. The other one that he built, and it's the way you can spot all his buildings, he uses something that's called the catenary arch,
yep.
which is between a U and a V. And he says it is the strongest form in nature. So it holds up things. So holds up that extraordinary, those walls and the roof of the Sagrada Familia. And if you're trying to visualise, because we're radio, trying to visualise what it's like, I'm going to really lower the tone now.
Okay.
But think of the McDonald's two arches on the M. They are both catenary arches there. That's the share. Sorry, really
no,
sorry.
It's great. No, it's
you're
great.
Going highbrow. I'm going lowbrow.
No, I just, you know, what I love about radio, Mike, because we always have, and we never have scripted interviews, is that we're eclectic, eccentric, and a little esoteric. Therefore, you can bring in everything from the Sagrada Familia, but I did not think we were going to bring in the golden arches from McDonald's. Here's the thing. Miel van der Rohe, another architect, says God is in the detail, right?
Yep,
and he's a brutalist, isn't he? Again, boom, yep. There we go. So, yeah, not, but so you can say that, yeah, in the case of Gaudi, God is indeed in the deal because there's so much detail in there. So it's not an, you know, Gabriel saying, no, you know, you've missed a keystone there, you know, go back and start again. So, you know, it really is the more you look, the more you see.
Absolutely. And the other thing about Gaudi is, well, let's get on to the man himself, because what I wanted to do in the book as well is appreciate the architecture for what he thought it was rather than what people said it was, but also understand him. Because one of the reasons the Sagrada Familia is so famous, think about it. So he started building it. He took it over from somebody else who was building a really boring church he would never have thought of ever again there. But he took it over and slowly changed it, then radically changed changed it as he went forward. 1882, dies in 1926. What exists in 1926 was going to be this huge building with 18 towers and three facades. One of the facades was almost done. One of the towers was completed and three of them were half completed. So little of it was done when he died. And people... Who are you going to say something?
So it's a triangle. Are we talking... It's three facades. Is this a... Because No.
Standard shirt shape. It's a Latin cross.
Right, okay.
So on the two crosses, of the bars of the Latin cross, nativity facade on one side, i.e. Jesus' birth, passion facade on the other side, which was done in the 80s. And interestingly, what Gaudi's big thing was there are no straight lines in nature. So God only knows why the people building it decided to commission an architect called Subarax, who made all the figures on it look like Lego men. I mean, you don't get more square straight lines than Lego. But anyway, they did, and that's there, and I think it's hideous, but anyway, there it is. And then the third one was going to be the glory facade, which is at the back, so you walk out of it, and that's the one that isn't quite finished yet. But so imagine he dies, 1926, Spain in turmoil, very little else happens, Spanish Civil War comes along. The Republicans see the Sagrada Familia, or what exists of it at the time, as a symbol of church power. So they ransack it. They smash all the models that he'd made. He worked by models, not by drawings. They smash his models and they think, OK, we've killed that church off now. No one's ever going to build it. Move forward, Second World War, austere 1940s into the 1950s. And then the era of tourism starts. And Franco's very keen on tourism. So people start coming to Barcelona. And they go and see. I mean, it's a bit like a lonely arch, the Nativity facade. It's all that's there, really. Yeah. And they go and look at it and think, wow, this is extraordinary. What kind of madman or genius was building this? And so people start going, and it builds and it builds. The numbers build and build. And as the numbers build, the money starts coming in, and they start thinking they could build it again. But the person who is at the centre of it was this really enigmatic man. It was very hard to find him. So if you think of our architects today, you know, Norman Foster, Frank Gehry, all of these people, all of whom say they've got a bit of Gaudi in them. I mean, we call them starchitects because they have such a big personality cult around them.
Yeah.
Gaudi never wrote a single thing down. He actually kept a diary for 1 year of his life when his mother and brother died, and he wrote 1,000 words in it. He rarely did interviews. And when asked about people, when people sort of say, oh, you're the architect of this amazing building, aren't you? He'd go, no, I'm just the doorman. So he kind of shrank away. And of course, think of the way that he died.
Yeah.
So he's walking down the street, sort of lost in thought. He'd become very eccentric in his dress by that stage. He would grow his hair, just let his hair grow, and then about once a month he'd shave it all off, and then he'd look bald, and he'd wear raggedy clothes. There's a lot of kind of self-punishment going on in him as well. He was a depressive. But anyway, so goes to, lost in thought, walks in front of a tram, bang, knocked down. Passers by think, oh God, some poor old tramps walked in front of the tram. Yeah. What should we do? So instead of sending him to one of the posh hospitals in Barcelona, which have all opened by them, they send him to the paupers hospital, the old medieval paupers hospital, which is where he dies. And they only realise it's him at the last minute. So he's this mysterious, kind of almost slightly romantic figure. And I am so ancient. Thank God it's radio. You can't see how ancient I am. But I went as a student in the early 1980s to see the Nativity facade. And I was just fascinated by the idea, who was this man? And people told me he was a priest. I thought, oh, that makes sense. He was a priest. You could see why a priest might do this. But of course, he wasn't. Yeah. And I've always been interested in it. And then in 2019, my daughter was in Barcelona from supposedly learning Spanish. I mean, she really wasn't doing anything other than having a good time.
Yeah.
But anyway, we went to visit her and we went to see the Sagrada Familia again. And it's now, at that stage, it was all, you could go inside it. There was something to go inside. So went and looked around and thought, what an amazing story. And still no one quite knows enough about him. So I went off, as you do, tried to buy a book about it. Boring architectural histories, which didn't tell me anything about him. Slightly sugary books written by people who believe he's a saint. So it just said, oh, he was so lovely. Everybody melted when they saw him, got better. Thought, don't want that either. I want to know about him. So I thought, I'll write it. So I've written it. And I've, you know, you draw on the recollections of the people around him. Lots of them wrote those down.
Yeah.
But the other way you get to know him, so imagine he had been a novelist. If he'd been a novelist, what would I have done to find out about him? I would have read his novels. I would have gone through them. So what do you do with an architect, particularly an architect who 95% of his buildings are in Barcelona? You go and you walk round and round and round and round again, all the buildings that he built at different stages of his life, and find out what it tells you about him.
Because here's the thing, you know, he doesn't export. He's not off doing a commission here and a commission there. He is, he is a stick of rock with Barcelona, with Barca written through. I mean, short of redesigning the Nou Camp, I mean, you couldn't get more Barca. And that makes it interesting because nothing exists in a vacuum, Peter. And at the time, and it's really tragic that the Republicans sort of burn down this particular church or smash up the models, because Barcelona stands against the, you know, Franco's fascism and Franco's architectural style. You only have to see the Valley of the Fallen and go, blimey, that is fascist. You know, that is fascist. It's not even Keats. It's just horrendous style. And you know, Franco's idea is the concrete blocks that go up everywhere in Spain. And you know, Spain has some pretty Spain's modernist architecture. You know, Ricardo Bofill and whatever, notwithstanding, it's pretty brutal and horrible and not in a good way. So, is it quite, you know, aren't we quite fortunate that the Gaudi is in Barcelona? Barcelona is Catalonia. The Catalans are different from the rest of the Spanish, as your daughter probably found out when she was trying to learn the language there.
Indeed, pointless, because they're all speaking a different language.
Exactly.
And then you're absolutely right. Place is so, so important. So what Gaudi's story is also completely framed by is that he was a Catalan cultural patriot, only ever spoke Catalan. Yeah. So in what I think it was in 1904, 1905, the King of Spain comes to visit the Sagrada Familia and they desperately needed money. They never had enough money to build it. So they wanted his approval. And the King starts speaking to Gaudi in Spanish. And Gaudi, the people who want him to be made a saint have to bear in mind he was a miserable old git some of the time. And he just carried on in Catalan and said, I'm not doing it. And so the King got cross and he got crosser and they got crosser and crosser with each other. So he absolutely, that context. And of course, the key moment in one of the key moments in his life is 1909 and the tragic week in Barcelona. So Barcelona, so certainly for me, I come from Liverpool, right. Even though I can make my voice show it, but it sort of drifted away over the years. But I come from Liverpool, and Barcelona's quite like Liverpool. Anyone who knows Liverpool, end of the 19th century, big booming industrial revolution, port, lots and lots of poor people flooding in, put in the worst possible accommodation, treated in the worst possible way, huge profits coming, people building enormous buildings, which is what went on in Barcelona too. You say Biguel, everyone who's been to Barcelona, Park Güell, Palau Güell, Finca Güell, Bodegas Güell, they're all there, all the things Gaudi built for him. And so in 1909, you just get this huge fracture that goes through Barcelona between the poor, the oppressed, the anarchists, the men who are about to be conscripted into some stupid colonial war that no one wants to go to, and on the other side, the army, the military, the industrial bosses and the church sided with them in that sense. And so the whole city kind of collapses around itself. People are burnt in the, murdered in the street, churches are burnt. And Gaudi is Gaudi, who in a sense had crossed between the two groups all the time. He'd always been one of those shapeshifters, I think we call them now. Yeah. He was in both groups. And it was kind of almost like someone pointed at him and said, you make a choice. You make a choice. You're with us or you're against us. And he didn't want to do it. So what he, in those last years of his life, what he saw the Sagrada Familia as was a symbol that God was there, and God was there for everyone, and the church would bring people back together. Hopelessly naive, obviously, because the Spanish Civil War didn't make that happen, but there you go.
Starter for 10 then, okay? I didn't realise that you're from Liverpool, okay? I didn't realise you're from Liverpool. You think Barcelona, you think Sagrada Familia, Cathedral.
Yeah.
You think Liverpool, and away from, you know, away from the Bund, you think modern, you know, modernist cathedral, Liverpool.
Oh, I love it. I think it's my favourite building in the world, Liverpool. I can't bear the Anglican one. Sorry, I don't want to be unecumenical. The Anglican one is a boring kind of copy of things they've built 1,000 times before. Liverpool Catholic Cathedral, Sir Frederick Gibberd.
Yeah.
People who don't know it, it's kind of round. It's got a dome of glass around the top of
it.
When the light comes in, it is fantastic.
Yeah, the one sunny day. Yeah, I was there the one sunny day. And it was like,
It's even light when there's no sun. You can still, there's always light in Liverpool. It's usually someone burning something, but there's always light in Liverpool. So I can say it. I'm from there. I can say it.
Exactly. What? Who's he studying under? Is he self-taught? I mean, is there? And who is his page? Who's his patron? As the saying goes.
Didn't really have a patron. So he, interesting, he is his, well, not interesting. You may not find it interesting. I always think when people say this is interesting and then sometimes it isn't, but he grew up in the Catalan countryside and his parents were, both came from a long line of artisans. They were metal workers. They made copper. So what he talks about in one of the few things that he does write down, he was a very sickly child, didn't go to school till he was 8 and used to go and sit with his dad in the forge. And he talks about the magic of watching his dad take a two-dimensional piece of copper and turn it into three dimensions. So he talks about understanding space. So he did go to Barcelona architecture school when he went there, but kept failing everything all the time. And they all thought he was a bit dim and not very good at it. They thought he was a bit mad as well. So when they finally gave him his degree, they said, we've either given a degree to a madman or we've given a degree to a genius. And actually he turned out to be both, really. So he didn't come from that kind of traditional route. So when we were talking before about where did he borrow his art, who did he take ideas from? He did, obviously. I mean, the core of the Sagrada Familia is Catalan Gothic. The core of it is a Gothic church, but instead of Gothic arches, he uses his Cantenary arches. And if you walk down the nave, the main body of the church in the Sagrada Familia, what the pillars are is their shape. They're stone, obviously, but they're shaped like great tree trunks, and they go up, and then they divide at the top into branches. So you have stone branches and stone leaves holding up this thing. It's astonishing. Just look up in awe at what he's put there.
And of course, there are a million fridge magnets around the world. You know, I went to Barcelona and all I got was this very colourful gecko or this Sagrada Familia with I heart Barcelona. I mean, How is he received by his public though at the time? Because now it's like, okay, you know, I love Gabby, but it's the shock of the new, and the people, the same way that people couldn't get their heads around, you know, sharks and formaldehyde. Is his work, they don't just go, oh, Gaudi, do me another golden arch. I mean, at the time, do people understand what he's trying to do?
He goes in and out of fashion. So the first really big building he built was in 1888, which is the Palau Güell, which you can see is just off the Ramblas. And it is quite modernisme. Güell was the richest Croesus, gave him everything he wanted. It's incredibly lavish inside. It's also incredibly dark. Yeah. But he built this huge light well. And that was opened in 1888, which was the year of the Universal Exhibition, the World's Fair in Barcelona. So everyone flocked in. Güell showed it off to everyone, king, queen, princes, bosses, whatever, they all came to see it, and everyone wanted him to build the next building. They all said, will you build our building now? Will you build us a fantastic house? And oddly, he then chose to build, well, to extend a convent school for some nuns, which actually, it's called the Theresian Convent. If you are ever in Barcelona, it's quite hard to get into. You have to persuade the nuns to let you go in. It is the building outside is boring, but inside it is the most beautiful building I've ever been. It's his most beautiful building in lots of ways. It's those Cantenary arches, all but painted white, no colour, going down and down and down, corridors filled with light, like you're walking into heaven. I mean, God knows, I'm sure I won't get into heaven. Yeah. But if I get into heaven, that's what I'd like it to be like. So he starts doing that, and he's very, very popular, 1890s, 1900s. But with the tragic week, with architectural styles change, economy changes, there isn't so much money, he becomes quite unpopular, but very well known. I'm not sure people ever really got it, but they kind of liked it. They called some of them really nasty names. So the Casa Bayo, which is the one that looks like it's underwater, it's got these very Art Nouveau windows that look over the Passage de Gracia. So the idea was the rich family who owned it wanted to sit doing their knitting or eating their tea in the front window, and everyone would walk past and think, shit, they're rich, I wish I was like them. So that's what they wanted. But he holds the Art Nouveau windows, he has these things that go across them to hold the bits of stone apart. Yeah. And people said that it was a bit like, well, they were either like mouths that were chomping bones, eating bones. They called it the House of Bones at one stage. And the Casa Mia, the one on the other side, that's this rock face of caves, and it's like waters rushing through all these caves on a rock face. People said it was a bit like Noah's Ark, and it was like a kind of mad zoo with people facing out of a mad zoo. So people didn't say the most complimentary things, but lots of people loved it. So, you know, the most famous architect of the 20th century, apart from Gaudí, Le Corbusier, the great, he went, he loved Casa Mia. It was the first time he'd seen people hang stone off a wall on the front of a building, so the rest of the building was freestanding. The roof of Casimir, if you do nothing else when you go to Barcelona, go up in the lift, there's just all these really weird forms on the roof. I can't tell you what they are. I can tell you what they might be. He never told anyone. It's almost like saying, go and walk out there and see what you think about them. They could be medieval knights, they could be Saracens, they could be chess players, they could be Star Trek figures, they could be anything you like, really. But it's like walking into a world of imagination. He's amazing. He's amazing. You can see, I like him.
I mean, depending on your mood, you see, they can be sinister or they can be benign, can't they?
Yeah.
Depending on how strong your coffee or other substance has been, it can scare the living what's inside it. Here's a question.
Too old for substances, Ben.
Caffeine, pure caffeine, as the saying goes. Trust me on this one. I'm just something you said a little bit earlier about trying to get into the, what was the building that you think this looks like, the entrance to heaven? What's it called again?
The Collegia Santa Teresa, the Theresian convent, which is up on the hill going up to Beyond Gracia.
I'm going to try. You see, the thing is, my question now is, Peter, how do you persuade a bunch of nuns to let you in? I've never been able to persuade a nun to do anything, not even give me confession. So how did you manage? Is it the white flowing robe and the, because I've got no hair. I'm insanely jealous of your mane, sir.
I don't think nuns like my hair particularly, but okay. This is a terrible secret. I don't know if you can do it, but when I left university and I wanted to be a journalist, it wasn't as easy as I thought it was going to be. This was the mid-1980s, bit of a Margaret Thatcher slump then.
Yep.
And the only job I could get was on a Catholic magazine. So I went to work for a Catholic magazine called The Tablet.
Yep.
And then I moved, as you do very quickly when you're young, to another Catholic magazine in London called The Catholic Herald. So when you knock on the door of the convent and you say, sorry, sisters, and they go, no, we can't, we're too old, we can't show anyone around. You say, Sister Mary of the Angels was the one I was talking to. I said, oh, but sister, I grew up Catholic in Liverpool. I was editor of a Catholic newspaper, and the door swings open. But give it a try. Just look as holy as you can and go say, I worked for a Catholic. Or I know that bloke with the long hair who turned up a few years ago. He'll vouch for me.
Last time I was in a Catholic chapel, literally the Virgin just sprang out of nowhere and said, this is Lugar del Silencio, and threw me and my confessor out. So therefore, Peter, I could talk about this. We haven't really got going on it, but until the proverbial celestial cows come home. If people want to find more information about you or this rather splendorous book, where should they find you?
They should look on Amazon and find the book, which is called God's Architect, and it's published by Hodder in English, available from all good bookshops. If they want to find out about me, I mean, I've got a website called peterstanford.org. It's very, very straightforward, and there's things on there that they can look at.
With ringing testaments from the Catholic Tablet, but also they can order it. They can also go to our virtual bookstore, click on the rather splendid front cover, and a well-known South American river-based firm will be winging it away to them directly. How's that for a plan, Peter?
That is a very good plan. And can I just say, I'm going to give it one more plug.
Go on.
One of the things that I wanted the book to look like, because Gaudi was,
Eight seconds.
Okay, very exquisite. So it looks like a Gaudi building, and even inside, it's full of colour pictures. I'm flashing it at the screen now, but I'm on radio.
I see. It's
beautiful.
It's beautiful.